The Murder on the Links, Agatha Christie. Chapter 16, The Baroldi Case. Some 20 years or so before the opening of the present story, Monsieur Arnold Baroldi, a native of Lyon, arrived in Paris, accompanied by his pretty wife and their little daughter, a mere babe. Monsieur Baroldi was a junior partner in a firm of wine merchants, a stout, middle-aged man, fond of the good things of life, devoted to his charming wife, and altogether unremarkable in every way. The firm in which Monsieur Baroldi was a partner was a small one, and although doing well, it did not yield a large income to the junior partner. The Baroldis had a small apartment and lived in a very modest fashion to begin with. But unremarkable, though Monsieur Baroldi might be, his wife was plentifully gilded with the brush of romance. Young and good-looking, and gifted withal with a singular charm of manner, Madame Baroldi at once created a stir in the quarter, especially when it began to be whispered that some interesting mystery surrounded her birth. It was rumored that she was the illegitimate daughter of a Russian Grand Duke. Others asserted that it was an Austrian Archduke, and that the union was legal, though morganatic. But all stories agreed upon one point, that Jean Baroldi was the center of an interesting mystery. Questioned by the curious, Madame Baroldi did not deny these rumors. On the other hand, she let it be clearly understood that, though her lips were sealed, all these stories had a foundation in fact. To intimate friends, she unburdened herself further, spoke of political intrigues, of papers, of obscure dangers that threatened her. There was also much talk of crown jewels that were to be sold secretly, with herself acting as the go-between. Among the friends and acquaintances of the Baroldis was a young lawyer, Georges Canot. It was soon evident that the fascinating Jean had completely enslaved his heart. Madame Baroldi encouraged the young man in a discreet fashion, but being always careful to affirm her complete devotion to her middle-aged husband. Nevertheless, many spiteful persons did not hesitate to declare that young Canot was her lover, and not the only one. When the Baroldis had been in Paris about 3 months, another personage came upon the scene. This was Mr. Hiram P. Trapp, a native of the United States, and extremely wealthy. Introduced to the charming and mysterious Madame Baroldi, he fell a prompt victim to her fascinations. His admiration was obvious, though strictly respectful. About this time, Madame Baroldi became more outspoken in her confidences. To several friends, she declared herself greatly worried on her husband's behalf. She explained that he'd been drawn into several schemes of a political nature, and also referred to some important papers that had been entrusted to him for safekeeping, and which concerned a secret of far-reaching European importance. They had been entrusted to his custody to throw pursuers off the track. But Madame Baroldi was nervous, having noticed several important members of the revolutionary circle in Paris. On the 28th day of November, the blow fell. The woman who came daily to clean and cook for the Baroldis was surprised to find the door of the apartment standing wide open. Hearing faint moans issuing from the bedroom, she went in. A terrible sight met her eyes. Madame Baroldi lay on the floor, bound hand and foot, uttering feeble moans, having managed to free her mouth from a gag. On the bed was Monsieur Baroldi, lying in a pool of blood, with a knife driven through his heart. Madame Baroldi's story was clear enough. Suddenly awakened from sleep, she had discerned 2 masked men bending over her. Stifling her cries, they had bound and gagged her. They had then demanded of Monsieur Baroldi the famous secret. But the intrepid wine merchant refused point blank to accede to their request. Angered by his refusal, one of the men incontinently stabbed him through the heart. With the dead man's keys, they had opened the safe in the corner and had carried away with them a mass of papers. Both men were heavily bearded and had worn masks, but Madame Baroldi declared positively that they were Russians. The affair created an immense sensation. It was referred to variously as the Nihilist Atrocity, Revolutionaries in Paris, and the Russian Mystery. Time went on, and the mysterious bearded men were never traced. And then, just as public interest was beginning to die down, a startling development occurred. Madame Baroldi was arrested and charged with the murder of her husband. The trial, when it came on, aroused widespread interest. The youth and beauty of the accused and her mysterious history were sufficient to make it a cause célèbre. People ranged themselves wildly for or against the prisoner. But her partisans received several severe checks to their enthusiasm. The romantic past of Madame Baroldi, her royal blood, and the mysterious intrigues in which she had her being were shown to be mere fantasies of the imagination. It was proved beyond doubt that Jean Baroldi's parents were a highly respectable and prosaic couple, fruit merchants who lived on the outskirts of Lyon. The Russian Grand Duke, the court intrigues, and the political schemes, all the stories current were traced back to the lady herself. From her brain had emanated these ingenious myths, and she was proved to have raised a considerable sum of money from various credulous persons by her fiction of the crown jewels, the jewels in question being found to be mere paste imitations. Remorselessly, the whole story of her life was laid bare. The motive for the murder was found in Mr. Hiram P. Trapp. Mr. Trapp did his best, but relentlessly and agilely cross-questioned, he was forced to admit that he loved the lady, and that, had she been free, he would have asked her to be his wife. The fact that the relations between them were admittedly platonic strengthened the case against the accused. Debarred from becoming his mistress by the simple, honorable nature of the man, Jean Baroldi had conceived the monstrous project of ridding herself of her elderly, undistinguished husband and becoming the wife of the rich American. Throughout, Madame Baroldi confronted her accusers with complete sang-froid and self-possession. Her story never varied. She continued to declare strenuously that she was of royal birth and that she had been substituted for the daughter of the fruit seller at an early age. Absurd and completely unsubstantiated as these statements were, a great number of people believed implicitly in their truth. But the prosecution was implacable. It denounced the masked Russians as a myth and asserted that the crime had been committed by Madame Baroldi and her lover, Georges Conneau. A warrant was issued for the arrest of the latter, but he had wisely disappeared. Evidence showed that the bonds which secured Madame Baroldi were so loose that she could easily have freed herself. And then, towards the close of the trial, a letter, posted in Paris, was sent to the public prosecutor. It was from Georges Conneau, and without revealing his whereabouts, it contained a full confession of the crime. He declared that he had indeed struck the fatal blow at Madame Baroldi's instigation. The crime had been planned between them. Believing that her husband ill-treated her and maddened by his own passion for her, a passion which he believed her to return, he had planned the crime and struck the fatal blow that should free the woman he loved from a hateful bondage. Now, for the first time, he learnt of Mr. Hiram P. Trapp, and realized that the woman he loved had betrayed him. Not for his sake did he wish to be free, but in order to marry the wealthy American. She had used him as a cat's paw, and now, in his jealous rage, he turned and denounced her, declaring that throughout he had acted at her instigation. And then, Madame Beroldi proved herself the remarkable woman she undoubtedly was. Without hesitation, she dropped her previous defense and admitted that the Russians were a pure invention on her part. The real murderer was Georges Conneau. Maddened by passion, he had committed the crime, vowing that if she didn't keep silence, he would enact a terrible vengeance from her. Terrified by his threats, she had consented. Also fearing it likely that if she told the truth, she might be accused of conniving at the crime. But she had steadfastly refused to have anything more to do with her husband's murderer, and it was in revenge for this attitude on her part that he had written this letter accusing her. She swore solemnly that she had had nothing to do with the planning of the crime, that she had awoke on that memorable night to find Georges Conneau standing over her, the blood-stained knife in his hand. It was a touch-and-go affair. Madame Beroldi's story was hardly credible. But this woman, whose fairy tales of royal intrigues had been so easily accepted, had the supreme art of making herself believed. Her address to the jury was a masterpiece. The tears streaming down her face, she spoke of her child, of her woman's honor, of her desire to keep her reputation untarnished for the child's sake. She admitted that Georges Conneau, having been her lover, she might perhaps be held morally responsible for the crime. But before God, nothing more. She knew that she had committed a grave fault in not denouncing Conneau to the law, but she declared in a broken voice that that was a thing no woman could have done. She had loved him. Could she let her hand be the one to send him to the guillotine? She had been guilty of much, but she was innocent of the terrible crime imputed to her. However that may have been, her eloquence and personality won the day. Madame Beroldi, amidst a scene of unparalleled excitement, was acquitted. Despite the utmost endeavors of the police, Georges Conneau was never traced. As for Madame Beroldi, nothing more was heard of her. Taking the child with her, she left Paris to begin a new life.